You're listening to WIOX Roxbury Community Radio at 91.3 FM and streaming at wioxradio.org.
WIOX is supported by the Daily Star, a regional source for community news, commentary, shopping tips, local sports, and community events. The Daily Star's Total Access delivers the newspaper and breaking news throughout the day on any digital device. More information at thedailystar.com.
WIOX is supported by the Roxbury Arts Group, presenting Hub New Music, a quartet consisting of flute, clarinet, violin, and cello, exploring a diverse palette of 21st century sounds as part of the Essential Thursdays performance series at the Old School Baptist Church on County Route 36 in the Denver Vega Valley, Thursday evening, August 10th at 7:30. More information at 607-326-7908. Or RoxburyArtsGroup.org.
You're listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local, in the Catskill Mountains on 91.3 FM and on MTC Cable Channel 20, and at wioxradio.org on the web and on any smart device. This is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. John, how's it going?
Not so soggy anymore, but it got a little wet earlier today.
Yeah, it was raining on us pretty good. We had to leave the woods when a torrential downpours occurred and lightning. So
I was down in near Coshecton area in Sullivan County this morning. And on the way back, I had to stop for a doe and two fawns, and they would not get out of the road, like would not move. She was nursing the fawns in the middle of the road, just standing there, blocking all traffic, and no one could move until they were done. We had to wait there.
What nerve.
Right, inconsiderate. All they had to do was move to the ditch.
Yeah. Oh, geez, man. I know. I saw doe and triplets over the weekend.
Wow.
Last week, which is very rare for my area, in the mature forest of the southern portion of the Catskill Mountains, and we don't have that many triplets. There are no farms to speak of, and very little young forest, and except for near where I live. Directly where I live. And so that was kind of cool to see. And other than that, I was doing some stump grinding, which I've never done before. And I can tell you what, trees are well anchored to the surface of the earth. Holy cow.
Oh, yeah? What'd you do?
Just ground up, I don't know, 25 stumps.
Jeez.
Something like that. And some are easier than others. But, you know, elm is the worst tree in the world. It just doesn't want to leave the earth, even though it dies from Dutch elm disease. Although these were never killed by Dutch elm disease, but it's hard to split. It might be the hardest wood to split because it just sucks in the head of the axe. But they're also hard to grind up, too. So so that was my experience over the weekend. And, of course, we had the Catskill Forest Association hosted the Forest Festival last Saturday, the 9th annual Forest Festival. So had beautiful weather. Beautiful.
Beautiful day, and it was just a great time had by all, and a lot of people showed up, and a lot of vendors showed up, so it was a great day.
Absolutely. But tonight, we're going to get right into it, and because we got a lot to talk about, we had a guy on from Harvard Forest, and I am the worst with names, but he recommended Ryan McEwen to talk about why oaks are disappearing. He's from the University of Dayton in Ohio. Ryan, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi.
All right. So, do I have that correct, Ryan, that you're coming from Dayton?
Yes, I'm at the University of Dayton.
And, you know, speaking with someone over the phone who you'd never met is always, you know, somewhat awkward, but I understand you were just in the Catskill Mountains.
Yeah. I have family there. My brother-in-law lives in the Catskills, and so we were up there visiting, and it's quite beautiful. It reminds me of Appalachian forests that I'm familiar with, but sort of broader valleys, and anyway, it's beautiful.
Yeah. I've never been to Ohio, but a lot of people from here actually go to Ohio to go hunt the almighty whitetail, so... Believe it or not, we have a board member who leaves New York State to go after Ohio whitetails. But
that's interesting because I saw a lot of whitetails on the roads there, so it seems like you've got a good population.
Population might be okay, but the quality is for another show.
Okay.
So, but so why are oaks disappearing? And before we get into that, let's just introduce yourself. So you're the Associate Professor of Ecology at the University of Dayton, is that right?
That's right, yes.
Okay, and I have here Environmental Biology Program Director.
Yes, that's right. So that's a degree program for undergraduates. I'm the director of that program. It's an experiential learning kind of focused program. We try to get students outside and spend some time getting hands-on.
And what got you into all this, Ryan?
I grew up in central Kentucky, rural kind of area, so I spent a lot of time on farms and fields and forests and fishing and such as a kid. And then in college, I sort of found my way, luckily, into a forestry major. So my undergraduate degree is in forestry, and while I was a forestry major, my forest ecology professor sort of picked me out of the class and said, "Hey, you ever thought about doing research?" And I said, "No. What do you mean research?" And so I started doing, actually, as an undergraduate, I did a project on a disease called dogwood anthracnose that kills dogwood trees. And just the very idea that you could ask and answer questions about forests in a scientific way turned out to be something that I was super interested in and good at. And so I ended up spending my life so far focusing on that as a professional.
Well, we got a question for you tonight: is why are oaks disappearing? And in the past, we've actually gone into this quite a bit. We've had Kim Steiner on from Pennsylvania State University, and he was talking about, you know, declining oaks. We've also had Mark Abrams on from Pennsylvania State University a week or two before then, and talk about the the lack of oak trees that are regenerating in our forests today, and a lot of them focused on fire. But we're going to go into You sort of bring something else to the table here. So, first of all, are oak disappearing, I guess? Some people may listen to this and not even believe that maybe they're disappearing or reducing.
Yeah. So, first of all, let me just say it's a great topic. It's an interesting topic, and it's a complex topic, and I'm glad you're doing a whole series of shows on this. It's great. The question, are oaks disappearing, the answer is, it seems to be the case, yes, that they're disappearing. And what we see is that if you go into a forest and you sort of look up and you look at the canopy trees, the trees above you, there's a lot of oaks there. And this is in a broad area, so almost, Ohio, Indiana, east all the way over to, Maryland, north, up to the Catskills, south to Georgia, broad area where we see oaks in the overstory, big oak trees, and they're hanging on. These trees live a long time. They live 300 and 400 years or more. Under those oak trees in the what we call sub-canopy layers, the regeneration layer, so if you walk into a forest and just look straight ahead or look down, what we call seedlings or saplings, there's not very many. In some places, we can't find any oaks, seedlings and saplings. And so one thing I do want to say about that, though, is it also depends on where you are in the landscape. So if you're in a drier area, maybe on a south-facing slope of a hillside, you do see oak regeneration in some of those areas or where there's been disturbance. But in sort of what we call cove forest, where it's sort of shady, sometimes there's few or none. And the overstory are large oak trees. And so it begs the question, what's happening here? And as those large oak trees reach maturity and start to die, are they going to be replaced by something else?
Right. Yeah, north-facing slopes here in the Catskills or anywhere are normally more moist. And, yeah, I agree with that anecdotally, that there's more northern hardwoods than the central hardwood oak in the Catskills.
Right.
So, okay, if they're disappearing, what are they being replaced by?
So it depends on where you are, but species that are replacing oaks are maples, like red maple and sugar maple, across a very large area. There's other species like black gum and some other species that are replacing them as well, and it depends on where you are. But the species that are most prevalent that are replacing oaks are sugar maple and red maple, and it sort of depends on the site. And in one particular forest, you can have sugar maple replacing oaks, if you want to call it that. Just put it this way, sugar maple dominating the seedling layer, sapling layer in one area, and red maple in another. So they seem to be winning right now.
Yeah, it seems like in our area, I notice the best quality sites that are well-drained are being, overtaken by sugar maple underneath, but on the subpar areas, more red maple. What do you think, John?
Yeah, most of those south-facing slopes that are a little drier, definitely more red maple.
Or wetter. Or too wet.
Exactly, or wetter.
Yes. Also, yeah. Yes. Yeah, red maple does well. It's interesting. It's very plastic, so you can see it on really dry sites, like a dry, sandy ridge, and you can also see it show up in sort of riparian or wet areas, too. So, yeah, I agree with all that.
Absolutely. Its other common name is swamp maple, after all. But, I totally agree with that. The maple is, we had one guy call it the tension zone, where the maples and the beech birch are replacing the oak, hickory, chestnut forest. I can't remember his name. I'm terrible with names. He's from Harvard Forest. Ryan, do you remember who I'm talking about? That's how we met.
Could be Neil.
Yes, Neil.
Yeah, okay.
Man. Okay, yeah, Neil, good guy. We got to get him on again.
Yeah, Neil Peterson.
Yeah. Yeah, geez. Yeah, that was a good show. So, now, all right, a lot of these guys have talked about oak fire and mesification.
Yeah, mesification.
So can you describe that, first of all, before we get into these other factors that are playing a role?
Yeah, okay. So the idea, the mesification idea, is basically that as these maples in particular are taking over the subcanopy strata in these forests, that's what I mean by subcanopy strata, is seedlings and saplings, smaller trees. As that happens, what happens is the environment gets wetter. They actually change the environment. And the forest, the idea of mesification is the idea that these oak forests are becoming more mesic forests. They're changing in character fundamentally. The idea is that, one important idea is that the driver of that, so the question is why? And one of the most important answers that people have been pursuing scientifically is the idea of fire. And so the idea is that we had fire as a sort of a disturbance process in forests, and then that's absent because we have fire suppression now in our forests, and that's what's caused this. And so that's a really deep subject. Why would that be? The answer is we think, or the hypothesis is, that oaks are more fire tolerant. The maples, so if you have fires in the forest, you're going to kill the maples and promote the oaks. And then if you remove fire from the forest, that sort of advantage is lost, and then the maples start winning. And so we have seen this very clear pattern. It's really across eastern North America, across North America, actually, where you know, the government got involved in the idea of fire suppression. We're going to put the fire, there's a thing called the 10 o'clock rule. If it's a fire started, we're going to put it out by 10 o'clock the next day. And they were really good at that. We've been really good at putting out forest fires. But it turns out that in a whole bunch of different systems, fire was a crucial part of the system, ponderosa pine and other kind of forests. And so that was not a good idea. It was a bad plan to put all those fires out. In the West, it leads to pyrogenic forests today that when they burn hot. They get crown fires. People are fleeing. If you just watch the news, there's helicopters flying over and people running, putting their dog in the Subaru and heading down the road to escape the forest fires. In the East, what we think the result of this sort of misguided fire suppression has been the change in forest dynamics, that now oaks aren't winning anymore, and our forests are going to transform because of it. So the idea of fire suppression as a driver of forest dynamics in the East is a really sort of popular and important idea. It drives forest management. A lot of people are thinking about how to regenerate oaks. The idea that oaks are disappearing is important for financial reasons. We like to make hardwood floors out of oaks. It's important for wildlife because they make these big, juicy seeds that a lot of wildlife species like to eat, and maples make pathetic samaras, and nothing wants to eat, really, in comparison. And so there's a wildlife reason why we're interested. There's a financial reason why we're interested. And so a lot of forest managers want to know what to do about oak regeneration, and the answer is out there. The idea is, well, you need to burn the forest. And so that's the big picture for mesification and the sort of oak fire hypothesis.
Yeah, I mean, Mark Abrams, I read a lot of his stuff, and it was kind of fascinating in that, you know, even a maple leaf has less lignin. You know, it sticks to the ground, gets damp, hard to get a ground fire. And many of us know, walking through the woods, especially as kids, you know, you slide on your butt on oak leaves because they become slippery and dry very fast. So I can sort of believe some of that. I mean, you know.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I don't know.
An interesting idea. I mean, we have to pursue it, though. You know, the idea that they eat, that's like a, what we would call in forest ecology, we'd say ecosystem processes or ecosystem properties are changing because of this, you know, nitrogen cycling or, you know, soil moisture. So all those things are being measured. There's people who are on that right now asking that question. It's an interesting one.
Yeah, and it's like, if it's true, I mean, personally, I think it is. But the thing is, I don't know how you can replicate fire like it was when, you know, these legacies on a large scale anymore. I really don't know. Culturally, legally, I don't know. I just don't know.
So the question becomes, so the story of fire, at least in some forests, I mean, I've done a bit of work in reconstructing fire history in Ohio and Kentucky, Cumberland, Allegheny plateaus. I don't know the Catskills as well, so I can't really speak directly to that. But the story is, the fire story is 1880 to 1930, there was a lot of fire. They were burning. It was frequent. It was probably quite intense. We see fires occurring in drought years, okay? One of the, you know, most significant drought years, you know, if you look at significant drought years, you've got fires. So you can imagine really dry forests. You can imagine these fires were really hot. And so that's something we just can't replicate. You just can't do that now with forest management. And, you know, people who are trying to manage for fire, they have to have a certain burn window. It's cool. Usually it's a March fire and not one in July where it's 96 degrees and hasn't rained for 30 days. And it's, anyway, the story of fire in eastern North America is really 1880 to 1930, a whole bunch of fire, frequent and intense. And the other thing I want to say about that is it was irregular. And so, you know, sort of a lesson for forest management is these fires were burn, 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 pause. And the pause could be 7 years or 10 years or 12 years, and then burn, burn again. So I think that was really important for the ecology of these systems, actually, that pause and that infrequency. Anyway, the idea is that 1880 to 1930, a lot of fire. After 1930, none. So if you do fire history reconstruction, you don't see it at all after 1930, or there might be some stray and occasional one. But
yeah.
Now, the other thing is, though, what happens prior to 1880? That's one question. And the other question is, what else was going on in that period from 1880 to 1930? And so I don't know if you want to jump right into that, but...
Let me just... So if you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. with Ryan and John. Tonight's topic is Why Are Oaks Disappearing with Ryan McEwen from the University of Dayton in Ohio. So, yeah, let's get into that, Ryan. You know, what was going on then?
Yeah, so the idea, again, the story of fire in these in oak forest of eastern North America in a general sense, of course, this is generalizing. Any particular spot, it could be a bit different, but 1880 to 1930, a whole bunch of fire on the landscape. All that fire, or in general, that fire is associated with oak regeneration. There's lots of oak regeneration during that time period. But the other piece is that that was a time period where there was lots of land clearing. In fact, we see, you know, when you go back into the historical records, and even if you go back and look at historical photos and such, you can see that this was a time of intense forestry activity in these forests. And actually, when we do the fire history reconstruction, what we commonly see is that it looks like the stands are actually regenerating all at once. It suggests that there was clear cutting. So you can imagine someone clearing the land. There may be agriculture in there, some Appalachian hillside corn plants, you know, corn fields there. Lots of burning. Some of it's intentional. Some of it's accidental. Some of it's arson. There were small gauge railroads running up some of these mountain hollows here in Kentucky or in Kentucky and Ohio. Extraction of the timber, right? Lots of fire on the landscape. But if you can just put yourself in that forest and open your eyes and look around, what you see is not trees over your head. It's been clear cut. The fires are transpiring in very open conditions. The forests have been hammered by land use change then. It's not, you know, it's not something we can just implement today. And so the context, the landscape context for this process is the forest being cleared, the forest being used. Oak regeneration is taking place in that landscape context. This is really important if you're trying to think about forest management today, because people are, and I know, by the way, I spend a lot of time I have in my career on prescribed fire sites. They're super interesting. From an ecological perspective. But normally when you're on one of those sites, you look up and there's big trees overhead and shade, right? There's shade from the canopy on the forest floor. That is not the case if you think about a fire that's happening in 1904 or 1911.
Right.
There's been clearing and five burns. And so that landscape context is really important for understanding fire as a process and understanding the regeneration dynamics of these ecosystems.
Well, that makes sense. That makes sense to me, because where fires occur today, which is probably very minuscule to maybe what it, you know, compared to 16 or 1355, I have no idea. But on the Shangham Ridge above between Ellenville and New Paltz in Ulster County, that's probably the biggest burned area in southeastern New York State. And it's not an old, does not have old trees, a mature canopy. But it lends itself to burning quite well. It seems to me that places that are asbestos-like or don't burn are places that have already been completely converted to agriculture, which is a green field, or very mature forest. It's that settlement error that creates fires, but I don't know.
That makes sense to me. I mean, I don't – the particular sites you're pointing to, I don't really – I don't know those sites, so I'm –
Yeah, I mean, just a 1,000 acres, for example, literally burned 2 years ago, and then another 1,000 to 2,000 2 years before that.
Yep.
This area was probably has the strongest legacy of fires in anywhere in southeastern New York, and because it's surrounded by valleys, it's got very shallow soils, and Native Americans probably burned the hell out of it, and the settlers did the same thing until the 1940s, when there used to be blueberry pickers up there selling berries to New York City.
Yeah. So what you're saying is, and I think this is another interesting point, is that unlike some places like Florida, for instance, in Florida, fire is a lightning-driven process. Fire in Kentucky and probably New York and Ohio and Pennsylvania, Maryland, West Virginia is an anthropogenic process. What I mean by that is usually it's started by people. I mean, we do get occasional lightning fires, but the system, what I'm talking about, this 1880 to 1930, you know, where we had frequent and widespread and intense fires in a whole bunch of forests in eastern North America, those were anthropogenic fires that are set by people.
Right. Yeah, they found 99% on the ridge that I'm talking about were started by people, and mostly for blueberry picking.
Yep, right. Makes sense.
Yeah. So you talk about this 125-year gap. You want to go into that?
That's the interesting piece, or that is an interesting piece. So as I mentioned, it's sort of 1880 to 1930 is where we know what we know. And what's harder to figure out is what's behind that window, the 1880. I mean, if you go to forests in a whole bunch of eastern North America and walk around, even what people sometimes like around here in the metro parks, they call old forest. If you core those trees, they're 90 years old trees. They started in, you know, 1920 or something. It's harder to find trees that are 1850, for instance. It's even harder to find really old trees. In fact, it's really complicated to try to, if you want to try to find fire scars from trees that will give you a fire history predating 1800, it's rare. We don't really have that data, even till today. So, you know, there's a problem here. We don't really know the fire history. I would say it's poorly understood prior to 1800 and certainly prior to 1650, let's say. Not well understood what's going on back in that time. And what makes it more complicated is we do have good evidence, and it's sort of well-known and logical also, that Native Americans used fire as a silvicultural tool, let's call it. So they were using fire. I mean, if you just imagine being in a forest and you don't have steel tools and you need to make a area, you know, you need to open the forest, what are you going to do? The idea is fire is a good tool to use. And so Native Americans were using fire. It's just logical. And so it was part of, I think it was part of our forest, the deep history of all of our forests here in eastern North America. Where it becomes complicated from the perspective of trying to understand the causation or the dynamics, you know, what drives dynamics in our forest, is that those societies were shattered. Native American societies were shattered by smallpox that swept through eastern North America in advance of the European settlers. European settlers oftentimes, and you should get an anthropologist on to talk about this. They know better than I do. But just from my research and talking to anthropologists, you know, this smallpox epidemic and other diseases that are Euro-American diseases, European diseases, swept through and shattered these societies. And we know, for instance, in Kentucky, where there was significant Native American activity, when these epidemics swept through, the societies were shattered, and they were literally decimated. And I mean that actually, you know, there was a tenth of the people left after these diseases came through. You had multi-tribal bands sort of forming together and fleeing. It was sort of apocalyptic, and what that meant for managing the forest, quote-unquote, with fire is hard to understand. I don't think we know the answer to that, and I don't think it's been really addressed.
Yeah.
We need to really grapple with that question, and it's a big window. It's a, you know, it's a 125-year window where when we just discussed, you and I just agreed that this is an anthropogenic fire regime, and the question is, how do you have an anthropogenic fire regime without people? Or with the people who aren't on the forest now because they're fleeing, or their, you know, their populations are devastated.
I'd make the case the Catskills might be a very interesting place for your research, and the reason why is it's one of the very few places in the East that were settled so late. We have some areas in the Catskills that weren't settled, like Frost Valley, until 1860s. And there's places on top of these ridges that were never farmed. That's the problem with Ohio and stuff in Pennsylvania is that, and most of New York State, is that the average pasture is well above their elevation. But yeah. We have some areas, few, but some, where the oak trees predate, they were never settled. And yeah. Maybe they should be studied.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. That sounds good. I mean, I think our old, the existing old growth forests, such as they are, I mean, in the state of Ohio, there maybe are none, really. They're really old growth forests that are intact, you know, are super precious resources, and we have to study those areas. And actually, your previous guest, Neil Peterson, is an absolute genius at finding old trees. I mean that word, genius.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've been on places on the Catskill Forest Preserve. Right, John? Remember where we lost our drone?
Yeah.
Remember where the drone went right into the mountainside and gave us tears? So it broke. We went up that mountain. As you go up, you run into these oaks on top of these ridges, very high ridges.
Yep.
And they're very old, all maple below it, but big red oaks on top. And never cleared up there because it was above the settlement line.
Yeah.
Pretty interesting, though.
That's a place where we need to get some cross-sections. Tree cross sections from down trees and build some fire histories. I mean, you know, the thing about, for instance, ponderosa pine in the West, where we've got this fire story, and there's you know, with fire suppression, and there is forest management using fire that's extremely successful. They spent a lot of time, you know, the restoration ecologists out there. They spend a lot of time building up what are thought of as reference conditions. Like, this is the historical fire regime, and you need old trees to do that, and you need to build back these fire scar records. So the fire scar records that we have, there are a few, but they're few and far between in Eastern North America because we just don't have the sites, and the sites that we do have are so precious you can't just go cut the trees down and get the fire scars. So, you know, it's quite tricky. But we don't have, you know, we're missing that. So it would be so fascinating to find out if somebody, you know, and this is a project that I have not been able to pursue. I wanted to pursue it myself, and maybe I will in the future. But it's just to keep pressing, and especially in forests of New York and Pennsylvania and Ohio and Kentucky and West Virginia, you know, mesophytic kind of forest, classical Appalachian forest, try to push back in time in some of these places and really build, you know, fire scar records. We do have some records that are pine-based reconstructions that are right on the top of some ridge. But, you know, you just can't – I just have significant doubts as to whether that's a good characterization of the landscape as a whole. Those piney ridges are so different than the cove forest. And in those cove forests, we see oak trees in the canopy. Right?
Yeah.
So that's where we're really missing the deep history. But it sounds like you got some sites there in New York.
I guess what we would debate about is whether those bony ridges have a stronger legacy of burning because of their dryness.
Yeah.
Or the coves were outcompeted a long time ago because of their rich soil. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we certainly see topographic patterns. What I mean by that is across the landscape where you've got dry sites and oaks are still relatively competitive. Down the slopes and more deeper soils, you've got you can't find oak seedlings. I mean, there's some sites I've been on where you just literally can't find an oak seedling, and you look up and there's huge oaks all over over top of your head, and you're thinking these guys are dropping, you know, 27,000 acorns a year or whatever.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Where's the regeneration? So there's definitely landscape patterns, but definitely landscape patterns to the oak regeneration. And I would imagine historical patterns of fire as well.
John, we don't have any oak regeneration, not too much here and there.
I can think of one site that's regenerating that I would say successfully.
What about those bony ridges you were talking about? The dry, up at the top of the mountain where your drone wrecked?
Nothing but a red oak overstory and not a single thing grown, not even in the midstory, unless it's, like we said, a sugar or a red maple.
Maple.
And nothing on the forest floor at all.
Right. Maple and beech in the mid and lower story.
Interesting. Okay.
Absolutely. And but sometimes with a lot of mountain laurel, too, which is another fire.
Yeah, mountain laurel, yeah.
Right.
Yep. Yeah.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. with John and Ryan. Tonight's topic is Why Are Oaks Disappearing? With Ryan McEwen. He's at the University of Dayton. And we're going to take a small break, and we'll talk to Ryan some more about why these oak trees are disappearing.
Too big for his bed. Nothing seems to fit. Those raindrops are falling on my head. They keep falling. So I just did me some talking to the sun. And I said I didn't like the way he got things done. Sleeping on the job. Those raindrops are falling on my head. Soon be turning red. Crying's not for me, 'cause I'm never gonna stop the rain by complaining, because I'm free. Nothing's worrying me. It won't till happiness steps up to greet me. Raindrops keep falling on my head, but that doesn't mean my eyes will soon be turning red. Crying's not for me, 'cause I'm never gonna stop the rain by complaining, because I'm free. Nothing's worrying me.
Hello, I'm Robert Steed, host of Uncompromising Music on WIOX, here to invite you to join me at an uncompromising live broadcast event, the Manhattan in the Mountains Faculty Concert. Instructors and students from the Manhattan in the Mountains program will be performing Dvorak, Schumann, Amy Beach, Duchnanyi, and Franck at the Doctoral Center for the Arts in the Village of Hunter, and live on WIOX Community Radio this Saturday evening at 8 o'clock. I hope you can join us. It's sure to be uncompromising.
WIOX is supported by Catskill Dream Team, real estate agents on Route 28 in Margaretville, with services designed to guide buyers through the process of finding full-time or weekend homes, working as a team with sellers and other brokers. Catskill Dream Team at Realty USA. Expect more. More information at 917-399-3243 or CatskillDreamTeam.com.
WIOX is supported by Columbia Green Media and their Daily Mail newspaper. From Ravenna to Palinville, from the Rip Van Winkle Bridge to the Catskill Creek, the Daily Mail's daily print edition, website, and social media presence are designed to bring the communities of the Catskills timely news, sports, and event information. More at thedailymail.net.
This is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. Tonight's topic is Why Are Oaks Disappearing? With Ryan McEwen from the University of Dayton out there in Ohio. Ryan, you still there?
I'm still here, yep.
All right. So, the show is flying by, which means it must be a good show, Ryan. And, yeah, we got 20 minutes left. So, you want to get into these other factors? We've talked a lot about fire and stuff, and you know, some other hypotheses about what is going on with oak.
Yeah, sure. You know, I do want to just, before we move on, I just want to paint this picture, kind of a picture, in sort of in the mind of the listener, maybe. So, the idea of fire and how we thought of it is, and it's even been talked about this way, that there was kind of a passing of the baton from Native American land use to Euro-American land use. And we're talking about a process, oak and maple regeneration, the musification. We're talking about a process here that took place, that is taking place. We can see when we look at the data, this really stretches from almost Maine to Georgia to the Carolinas to the Mississippi River, huge area. So the idea is that across that area and all those different sites, there was this fire that was burning because of Native Americans, and then the baton was passed. The question I have, and we'll leave it here as a question, is, you know, my opinion is the baton hit the ground. It clattered and fell on the ground. It stayed there for 100 years and so in a lot of places. And so the question is, how do you have a fire regime that's anthropogenic at that scale over when there's no people on the landscape or the reduced population? And what happened when that baton hit the ground? So anyway, I'll leave it there. That's just a question. As far as the other factors go, you know, the other thing about this time period from 1880 to 1930, all kinds of other things were happening. That's a time when we're super confident. Like the time prior to, say, 1800 or 1650, there's not a lot of confidence. But the times where we have really good data, clear indication of lots of fire on the landscape and lots of oak regeneration, where these things are correlated nicely, is this period 1880 to 1930, where there was an intensive land use and people in the landscape. A whole bunch of other stuff happened over that time scale. I mean, one thing is we've already talked about is clearing. So if you just clear a forest, there's a whole bunch more lights on the forest floor. And so if there's agriculture or whatever. Other things that happened is there was a whole bunch of wildlife dynamics during that time period. So we had populations just crash of even things like white-tailed deer we were talking about before, and then rebound post 1930, 1940, 1950. And actually, I know a researcher in Pennsylvania named Walter Carson, who he would say the story of oaks is a story of white-tailed deer, period. That's the story. I don't know if you'd say it quite that clearly, but his research indicates it's a deer story. And, you know, there are other species, too, that are wildlife species that had some impact. One super interesting one is this passenger pigeon story, which I think is, you know, we don't have really good data. So it's hard, it's sort of hypothetical, but the idea of very almost unimaginably large flocks of passenger pigeons that could be breaking down, you know, branches, creating more light on the forest floor, and what impact they had on forest dynamics is sort of unknown. And there's a whole bunch of other species, too. The point is that there's this wildlife, a species dynamic, and many of those species you would say, oh, they're very important. Passenger pigeons, super important species in terms of forest dynamics. White-tailed deer are very, very important. What about wild turkeys? What about, black bear? Anyway, I think the wildlife story is really interesting, and it also correlates. And that's the thing. There's a lot of these processes that are correlating, and I think that's, to me, the fascinating piece is thinking about how these different multiple factors interact to drive forest dynamics. And so land use is a piece of it, super important by itself. You know, if you just clear a forest and go out there with a hoe and start hoeing it up and planting your corn, and then walk away and get a factory job and leave the land for 40 years, you change the forest dynamics. And if the white-tailed deer population crashes to minimal and then booms like it has in a bunch of areas, you've changed forest dynamics substantially. So we've got this landscape, this land use pattern. We've got a fire pattern. We've got a wildlife pattern, and then we've got another thing, which is, something really interesting, which is a long-term pattern in climate. And so we have good evidence now, and this is getting stronger and stronger through time, actually, from reconstructions, that we're in a period of warmer and wetter, and cooler and wetter. And the prior, so we've got, you know, our reconstructions, and this is the work from Neil Peterson again, our reconstructions show significant droughts that, you know, would make our Dust Bowl drought look pretty insignificant, happening over and over again from, say, you know, 1600s to 1900s, and then a whole bunch of pluvials after that. The pluvials are wetter conditions. And so trying to tease out what that means for forest dynamics is an interesting piece. So really, you know, what's fascinating to me is to think about all these things happening at once. So there's this land use pattern. We've got this climate pattern where it's wetter, there's more pluvials, there's less droughts. These things happening all together. And the last piece I'll say is that the story of oaks and maples, when it relates to fire, is oftentimes a story about physiology and about how all the seedlings operate. So oaks put a whole bunch of carbon below ground. They make big fat roots when they're burned. They have sometimes they're called grubs. That's a fire strategy. But it's also a drought strategy. And so if you can imagine a much droughtier forest for 400 years, you can imagine oaks winning. And of wetter conditions for 100 years, you can imagine maples winning. It's pretty easy to put those things together. And the thing about climate is it solves a whole bunch of the other problems. Like, if you think about, what about fire regimes across an area from, you know, a huge area of eastern North America? Does it make sense that the fire regime and this baton hitting the ground, that's hard to put it all, you know, to make that pattern fit. But if you think about climate, it does fit at that scale. So these things are all happening together. And I think just in terms of scientifically, that's really interesting, and I'm excited to kind of see where things go.
Yeah, there's so much to be learned. And the climate change is, I would think cooler and wetter would help out maple for sure. Dr. Michael Kudish around here, he retired Paul Smith professor. That's what he believes, that, you know, it'll promote sugar maple even more.
Yeah. Well, the evidence is pretty strong. And I'll just tell you another piece of it is, I mean, some of these droughts that we saw historically, and this work's still being done, of course, and refining it, but, you know, you think about the Dust Bowl as a society-changing, you know, event. Some of these droughts are much more severe than that and much longer lasting. You know, we have droughts lasting 15 years, 18 years. So you can imagine from a forest perspective, that could be a really, really impactful in terms of long-term dynamics. And in terms of filtering is what we say in ecology, species filtering, super powerful. I also think it's important for society. You know, we've got, not in the Catskills, of course, it's super wet, but especially in the West and in the South, we've built really water-fragile societies. And, wait and see what happens in this. But, you know, we had practical emergencies in California. Just now seems to be ending, but we're on the cusp of environmental refugees from drought out there just in the last couple of years. So, I don't know. Just, I guess my thinking just from, and I'm not a climate reconstruction guy, but just knowing those guys, knowing the people who are doing it and kind of seeing the inside of that work, I'd say we need to be super, super worried about it and much more careful about how we construct our societies in relationship to water security. Anyway, I'll leave that aside.
Yeah. We've had Charles Mann on, and he wrote, he wrote the book 1491, yeah. Talks about the Columbian Exchange.
Yeah.
And again, you know, you've already talked about this, but I just wanted to say, like, it's hard to prove what happened, you know, before, let's just say 1850 or 1830 or whatever, or 1700 or 1300. But I just feel like my idea is that the Native American impacts were grossly underestimated. I still believe that. And the only reason why I say that is just using, like, just think about how little time the Europeans have been here, settlers. Yeah. And look how many apple trees there are stretched across the Catskill Mountains. The whites, the Hudson Valley and every valley in between. And it's amazing how little time that happened. I just have a hard time believing that thousands of years since the glaciers receded, that the Native Americans weren't burning as much more, so much more than we thought, and had so much more impact on the Oak Hickory Chestnut Forest. But I can't prove it. You know, I just can't prove it. But they had to be eating something.
Yeah. Oh well, sure. And there's some evidence that you know of places in Kentucky I know of. Again, I know some anthropologists working there. You know, Eastern Kentucky as a independent place where agriculture was being invented. You know, there was, you know, agriculture in the strict sense being practiced there, and some places sort of cultivating species. So absolutely, I totally agree with that. Actually, this is Alfred Crosby's idea of a Columbian exchange is a fascinating one, and you know, I think it's obviously an important moment, crucial moment in the biology of especially the Western Hemisphere.
We're trying to cover so much tonight, but what do you think about, you didn't cover it, is the American chestnut. What do you think effect that had on oak?
Yeah, I left that on the side. You know, the American chestnut story is another interesting one that's sort of wrapped up. These things are all wrapped up in a ball together, which makes it so, you know, scientifically interesting. You know, the American chestnut, again, there's some conversation about in the science, you know, of ecology, forest ecology, sort of what it meant to lose that species. I mean, there's some areas where it's pretty clear that American chestnut was a dominant, maybe, you know, taking up 80% of the basal area in some forests. I mean, a real dominant species. And the pollen record shows that that thing came on the scene kind of fast. So where did it come? That part's interesting, too, and whether that's a sort of some kind of Native American artifact or what was going on with that species is really fascinating. Anyway, at some point it was a canopy dominant in a whole bunch of forests, not across the whole, you know, as I've been painting, this sort of Maine to Georgia, coastal plain to Mississippi, not that whole area, but a lot of Appalachian forests. Chestnut was super, super significant species. Then this blight comes, and they all die. I mean, they're all dead. It's unbelievable. And some, you know, the site that I spent a lot of time in Kentucky working on doing research, you still see the sprouts. It's interesting. You can see just a decaying stump there. And you know that tree used to be 90 feet tall, you know, and huge, and raining these delicious nuts on the forest floor. And what does that all mean? And now it's just a, you know, it's a sprout. It's 8 feet tall, and it dies back, and then it resprouts again. But the loss of that species and the sort of elbow room it had in the forest and what that meant for forest dynamics is something we're still grappling with. It's been something that you know, scientists have been working on, thinking about for a long time. But one of the pieces is you lost that mast, what we called mast. This, you know, you lost these nuts from the forest. Now, what are species, wildlife species, going to eat instead of those? And the idea of switching over to acorns is a you know, seed predation kind of mechanism is interesting one to think about. I don't think we know for sure, but it's a sort important and sort of fascinating piece of the puzzle. And you may know this, but there's a big effort going on for chestnut restoration. The American Chestnut Foundation has been working on the idea of creating blight-resistant chestnut trees and reintroducing them. The work seems to be going well, but there's some other problems. But there's a lot of interest in American chestnut.
Yeah, we've had SUNY ESF's, I forgot his name too, but he talked about the transgenetic tree that they're working on. And that's archived at Catskill Forest Association's website. But, Ryan, we got a few minutes left. And, you know, I don't want to leave on the worst note of doom and gloom on oak. What do you have any recommendations to a landowner, forest owner, about what they can do without fire to promote oak?
Without fire.
Yeah.
No answer.
Yeah, I was going to say, fire is an interesting tool. I just want to make this clear. I think it's personally fascinating. If I was a forest manager and had whatever tools at my disposal, I would introduce fire and leave the oak question aside and think about it from a landscape diversity perspective, because we can only burn a small portion of any property normally.
Well,
introduce some diversity into the forest. It's really interesting. I love working on those sites where the fire has been introduced. But generally speaking, leaving a fire aside, the idea is you need light on the forest floor. So you would need to do the other option would be doing some kind of thinning. I would think maybe you could develop some kind of management plan where you're creating gaps in the forest, maybe selective harvesting or something, to create some light on the forest floor. I don't know if you need to go in behind that and do some planting. I'm not sure. It sort of would depend on whether there's a seedling pool there at all. But, it may be a kind of, if I was drawing up a plan and you couldn't use fire and it was shady and there's maples, I would say, okay. And then the landowner said, I got to have oaks. I want oaks. I would say, okay, well, we got to have light on the forest floor. So we're going to have to take some stuff out, and we're going to have to probably bring some oaks in, so maybe plant some seedlings. I'm not sure. And then you better put a tube on the seedling, because Walter Carson, the guy I was talking about before, his whole thing is you're going to have a deer is going to come eat that thing. It's going to be, there's going to be browse damage. Browse damage is a serious problem. So you probably need tree tubes, and you need light. And you probably have to manage them a little bit. You may need to go out there and, almost go out there with a, machete or something to clear out and give those oaks a boost out of the seedling layer, into the sapling layer. That's the real bottleneck.
Yeah.
Once you get an oak to be 10 feet tall, you're fine. It's going to be fine. It's going to be just fine. But getting it from 3 feet tall to 10 feet tall in the forest is a trick.
Yeah, in order to be established. And yep. The Catskill Forest Association, John and myself, we do crop tree releases on oak if you want to preserve those. But, Ryan, thanks for coming on. That's all the time we have for tonight, and I'm sure we could have talked for another hour, and we'll have to have you on again.
Yeah, well, that was interesting. I appreciate the time, and I appreciate your attention to this topic. It's a fascinating topic.
All right, thank you again.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yep,
have a good night. And that's all the time we have on From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. And up next is Mostly British with Rick Nubling. Have a good night.
Good night, everyone.
From the forest, his tears fell on the sidewalk as he stumbled in the street. A dozen faces stopped to stare, but no one stopped to speak. For his castle was a hallway, and the bottle was his friend. And the old man stumbled in from the forest. Up a dark and dingy staircase, the old man made his way. His ragged coat around him as upon his cot he lay. And he wondered how it happened that he'd end up this way, getting lost like a fool in the forest. And as he lay there sleeping, a vision did appear. Upon his mantle shining, the face of one so dear, who'd loved him in the springtime of a long forgotten year. Flowers did bloom in the forest. She touched his.
Pond frogs glug and ping. Trees start to dance. We all wait for the weather. WIOX, Roxbury.
WIOX is supported by the Catskill Mountains Scenic Byway, covering 50 miles of mountain scenery, clear waterways, rolling farmland, and historic hamlets, winding through the heart of the Catskill Mountains on New York Route 28, from Olive to Andes. More information at sceniccatskills.com.
WIOX is supported by Franklin Stage Company in Franklin, New York, presenting Orson Welles' Shylock, the mostly true story of the many attempts Welles made to play Shakespeare's Shylock and the heartbreaking ways the actor's own life overlapped with the iconic character.